You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Strobe Talbot, and it is my great pleasure and honor to welcome you here today for what I think is going to be a particularly timely and meaningful discussion that is going to involve all of you. We have a terrific group of speakers and panelists, but we also have a very good audience, both here and connecting by means of technology, and I'll come to that point in a moment. As you all came in out of the rain, I assume it's still coming down a little bit out there, you came past a bookstore on your way into the Falk Auditorium here at Brookings, and that is significant. We do books at Brookings. We're in the Zuckerberg era, but we're also in the Gutenberg era. And we are here today to talk about a book by two of my colleagues, Elizabeth Niebone and Alan Berube. The book has a title which for some of us, and I would put myself in this category, up until the point that I learned about the work that Elizabeth and Alan have been doing, it has a little bit the quality of a head snapper, or even a bit of a oxymoron, Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. And I'll personalize this point by saying that I'm of a certain age and of a certain geographical background. I grew up in the eastern suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, including in the 60s when the Huff area of Cleveland, Ohio was in flames, literally in flames. And, of course, that was a time when we tended to associate, almost as part of the American dream, accompanied by something of an American nightmare, of course, the suburbs were where you found prosperity and the good life. Now, as I think all of you, because this is a very sophisticated audience, knows, more poor people live in the suburbs now in America than in the inner cities. And unfortunately, policy has not yet caught up with that reality. Policy is still, as it were, harnessed to a bygone era. And what Elizabeth and Alan have done is they have come up with a set of prescriptions, good ideas, pragmatic ideas, bold ideas on how to bring policy into line with this new reality. Now, this project owes a great deal to a long-standing relationship between the Brookings Institution and the Ford Foundation. For the past 4 years, Ford has supported our Metropolitan Policy Program, where both Elizabeth and Alan are key colleagues, in a series that we call the Metropolitan Opportunity Series, which has brought out a number of very, very useful, high-impact reports and recommendations. And those, I think it's fair to say, have created some of the groundwork for the book that we're going to be talking about today. Now, more generally, the relationship between Brookings and the Ford Foundation goes back a very long time. We owe our existence, of course, to Robert S. Brookings back in 1916. But decades ago, Ford became an absolutely crucial and transformative supporter of this institution and its work over the decades. We are, therefore, particularly honored to have the president of the Ford Foundation, Luis Ubiñas, here with us, and he will be the next person to address you. He's been a friend of this institution and a friend of many of us here, notably including myself, for the last number of years. I have learned a lot from him. I even learned a little bit from you, Luis, this morning in kind of a sidebar conversation we had on the larger question of which today's topic is a part, which is how we govern our communities at every level, from the local to the urban, to the suburban, to the national, and indeed to the global level. And Luis, at the helm of the Ford Foundation, has engaged one of the world's great philanthropies in how to improve governance at all of those levels, notably including, I might add, the global level. And here I'm thinking about the good work that he and his colleagues have done on what I think is perhaps the defining and existential challenge of our time, which is climate change. So I'm going to turn the program over to him, but first I want to go back to modernity, and this is something I'm still getting used to. It's not just us in this room, folks. This is a webcast program here this morning. So when we get to the discussion, and please wait to ask a question or make a point, preferably ask a question, until a microphone comes to you, because we're going to be webcasting the entire program, and keep in mind that we want to include the people who are following it in that way. And then, of course, I know it's not Mr. Zuckerberg's company, but Twitter is also part of our way of communicating the proceedings today. Usually, back in the old days, I would ask, when I was introducing a distinguished speaker like Luis, to ask everybody to please turn off your mobiles, and you should turn them on to either vibrate or silent, but do keep them on if you intend to tweet the proceedings. I'm told that the hashtag is hashtag suburban poverty, one word. So with that, Luis is a pro at this. He'll probably be tweeting even as he addresses you now. So the microphone is yours, Luis.
Good morning, everybody, and good morning, everyone who's on the webcast. You know, it's a testament to the power of Twitter that it gets free advertising from Strobe Talbot. I want to thank Strobe. I want to thank him because he has led this institution spectacularly for the last 10 years. It's America's premier think tank, and it's that way because of Strobe's leadership, because of his exceptional team. This idea of independence, rigor, and quality. This morning he said, you know, facts are important. He said it in a much more eloquent way, but he said, facts are important. Facts are important because they're the things that guide discourse, they're the things that shape conversation, they're the things that are the basis of any real decision. And we're sitting in a house of facts. We're sitting in what is America's premier think tank, and not that rankings matter, but in fact it was externally validated with some little survey by somebody or other recently. Wouldn't it be nice to be validated by a survey that you're the best at anything? But that's a tribute to Strobe's leadership and vision, and I have to say that it's an honor to be here. One of the things I've done at Ford in my time there is just come back to this house, just build our relationship to an even stronger place. And we've done that not because we have an inherent love of Brookings. It's because we have an inherent love of the facts and ideas that an institution like this generates on behalf of all of us. Now, about today. You know, I'm going to talk about this a little personally for a minute. I was born 50 years ago. 50 years ago, just this year. At a time when this country was doing something that these days seems almost unimaginable, it was declaring a war on poverty. Or, the way I think of it, it was declaring a war on behalf of the poor. Lyndon Johnson, who we sometimes forget, cared about these issues so deeply, said, "It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice, but we shall not rest until that war is won. The richest nation on earth can afford to win it. We cannot afford to lose it." That was, you know, he was the president of the United States. Those words were coming out of the most powerful man in this world. You know, what came next were real things. Real things. Head Start, Job Corps, Vista, and a slew of other tangible, material, real programs. And we know that it was transformational. you know, people forget that it was transformational. In 1964, at the beginning of that war, 19% of the country found itself living in poverty. 19%. One out of every five Americans. By the end of the decade, 6 years later, 72 months later, that rate had dropped to 12%, less than two-thirds. The war was successful. One out of every three, more than one out of every three people who'd been living in poverty 72 months earlier, was no longer living in poverty. Now, for me, and maybe others in this room, those initiatives were more than just statistics, more than just ideas, more than just intangible notions that affected other people. As a boy growing up in the South Bronx, I was raised by a mother who made $50 a week, sometimes less. We lived in a tenement surrounded by what were then the most dangerous streets in the country. For us, for me and likely some of you in this room, the war on poverty offered the hope of a better life and created opportunity for the kind of limitless lives so many of us here now lead. I know I'm not alone. I want everyone in the room to just step back and think about how your life was changed by the war on poverty. Maybe it was like for me, food on your plate, but maybe it was about just living in a more just society. Just step back and think about that. One third of your neighbors who had been living in poverty, no longer living in poverty. They might not have been your neighbors next door, but they were your neighbors spiritually. Now, for many of us, the trajectory of our lives was changed by that war. The trajectory of our lives was changed by that reality. We are in this room because the President of the United States spoke of that war on poverty, that war for the poor. And let me just also say, as we kick off this day, because I want us to ground the conversation this day on this idea of poverty and what it means, let me just also say that it gives me great pride that many of those original anti-poverty programs were backed by the Ford Foundation. And I say this not immodestly, because this all happened well before I was there. It's what reminds me of my responsibility day to day to make sure that institution, the institution I run, is as strong and powerful as it can be. Those programs, initiatives like the Gray Areas program in Boston, Oakland, and Washington, Bobby Kennedy's work in Bed-Stuy, the CDC, the idea of the CDC and its work, those programs were all based on collaborations like the collaboration you're going to hear about today, work with the Ford Foundation and places like the Brookings Institution, places that cared about this issue, that cared about this war, that created the intellectual groundwork for that future, those programs, those ideas that changed lives. But if you think about today, back to Twitter and Facebook and names like Zuckerberg, you know, Tumblr, and everything else we've just grown accustomed to. If you think about today, we know that the deep-rooted inequities the war on poverty attempted to end are still with us. And they're more complicated. They're more complicated because the geography of poverty has fundamentally changed in a way that makes it harder to deal with. The majority, and you heard Strobe say this, you know this, you've seen this. If you've lived in San Francisco, you notice the dearth of poor people. If you go to the Richmond, just across the bay, you notice the concentration of poor people. If you live in Manhattan, you see the dearth of poor people. If you go to the parts of Brooklyn that don't have mass transit and those old inner suburbs just beyond the city's borders, you see the concentration of poverty. Today, suburban communities like Seat Pleasant in Maryland, Edgewater in Colorado, Mount Vernon, of all places, in New York, are home to many of America's poor. People living there face many of the same challenges many of us living in places like the South Bronx faced 50 years ago. American suburbs, the aspirational place, the place you dreamt of going. If you drove a cab, you saved your dollars to buy that house, have today become home to the same cycles of poverty that trapped people in the infamous bleak urban ghettos of the 1960s and 70s. A child growing up today in one of those poorest suburbs, one of those poorest zip codes, faces many of the same challenges a child growing up in the South Bronx did in the 1960s. You have to transpose the neighborhood that poor person lives in. You have to bring yourself into a new reality. You have to imagine not the housing project, but that suburban home that was once someone's dream. Now, there's a difference. Absolutely, 50 years ago, we lived in substandard housing and went to underperforming schools. We had a dearth of good jobs. We had all the things we understand. Neighborhoods of poverty have vast crime problems. But the concentration of people and the concentration of urban resources, things like transportation, cultural assets, the proximity between jobs and housing, even in the poorest neighborhoods, the proximity of community and family knitted together that community. And it kept many of us from sinking into even more deep poverty, even deeper poverty, the kind of isolated poverty that so often is the case in suburban communities. For poor suburban families, these challenges are very, very different. They, instead of being knitted to jobs by mass transit, instead of having the number 6 train linking the South Bronx to the Upper East Side, face long commutes, lack of reliable public transport, an absence of basic health and social services. There is no municipal hospital network in a small suburban town. All the basic supports that helped us survive, that in many ways were legacy assets of those very poor neighborhoods, are blank in these new suburban neighborhoods where poor people now live. That is the new reality. That is the new reality. If people living in places no better off, but without community as a safety net, without legacy assets contributing to their lives, without transport connecting them to opportunity. And that's why in 2010, the Ford Foundation committed $200 million to a new Metropolitan Opportunity Initiative. You know, we didn't announce it on the radio and on television. We just went about and started the work. It's a new effort. It's a new effort to support innovators who are reaching beyond the borders of individual neighborhoods to connect people to opportunities in their wider metropolitan region, asking, how do we get the deep poverty of the Richmond and San Francisco connected to the immense wealth and job creation engine that is the corridor between the city of San Francisco and Palo Alto, where so many of these companies we're all joking about this morning exist and where so many of them actually face labor shortages? It's through that work, by the way, that we're proud to partner so closely with the Metropolitan Policy Program here at Brookings. They have been an intellectual engine and force for that work, for that investment we're making all over the country. Their work, including the book by Alan and Elizabeth that you'll hear about today, is helping policymakers and the public move outside of these outdated perceptions of what poverty really means and where poverty lives to the new reality, this new reality of suburban poverty. Their work reminds us that poor people, like so many others, are drawn to regional employment opportunities. They participate in metropolitan labor markets, search for homes on a regional basis, and work in industries and services that are within close geographic proximity, but often just beyond their reach. That's why it's so critical to think of access to opportunity not as an urban or suburban opportunity, not as this idea that Detroit is dying while Ann Arbor, just 45 minutes away, is thriving, but as a challenge that affects the entire metropolitan area, that both Ann Arbor and Detroit benefit from the kind of linkage that Ann Arbor needs to fill its jobs and Detroit needs to feed its people. Only by accepting this new geography of poverty can we define solutions that address this problem holistically, that address the immense inequity of having our poorest people live just beyond our sight, just beyond our sight, not on our subways, not in our museums, not in our parks, just beyond our sight, inaccessible to us as we are inaccessible to them. It means addressing issues like suburban affordable housing, access to mass transit, streamlining and simplifying the processes by which states and counties provide a range of benefits to families. Now, all of these ideas are highlighted in Alan Elizabeth's book. And I'm just proud to say that throughout that book, laced throughout it, are our grantees, people like the Transit-Oriented Affordable Development Fund, the Metropolitan Planning Council of Chicago, the Urban Institute's Work Support Strategies Initiative. By the way, the Urban Institute, another fantastic partner of ours. These innovative leaders and countless others, our grantees, our partners all over the country, are not only advancing creative solutions to both entrenched and emerging problems, they're giving us models for what an effective and modern effort to expand opportunity looks like. But it begins with an understanding of where those challenges are. And I'm hopeful that today's event will help us be grounded in this idea. This idea that today's poverty is no less urgent than the poverty President Johnson declared war on. That today's poverty is no less painful to the people suffering it than it was to those of us suffering it 50 years ago. But that it looks different, and that in many ways it's a harder poverty. That isolated poverty is a kind of hopeless poverty that we have to begin to address, in particular because it's less visible to us, in particular because it's more isolated from us, in particular because we won't run into it on the subway or in the park. We'll drive past it on highways. Anyway, as President Johnson said 5 days ago, this is about 5 years, 50 years ago. You know, that's spoken like someone who just has been in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Washington twice, and New York since last Monday. I think in my prior life I was an airplane pilot, and now I'm penalized by having to be a passenger for the rest of my existence. But you know, President Johnson said we can't afford to lose this fight. I think when he said that, he meant the responsibility we have for the poor. I think of it differently. I think we can't afford to lose this fight because our spirits shouldn't allow it. We can't afford to lose this fight because we need to wake up every morning and understand that the benefits we have, the joy we have, the safety and security we have, has to be grounded in the idea that there are people out there who don't have that safety and security, and that it's not right that we benefit from the joy of enough when others so profoundly suffer the want of too little. So with that, let me introduce Elizabeth Nebon. Elizabeth is a fellow of the Metropolitan Policy Program here at Brookings, focusing on poverty, this idea of metropolitan demographics, tax policies that support low-income workers and communities. In other words, Elizabeth does all the work we do at the Ford Foundation. She's the co-author of this, Confronting Suburban Poverty. It's the groundbreaking book we're going to discuss today. But she's also helping us think through what we do next. Thank you, Elizabeth. Come on up.
Thank you, Luis, for that introduction, and to you and the Ford Foundation for your leadership and support that you've shown in this area for years. And thanks as well to the Annie E. Casey Foundation for their contributions toward this project. As Strobe mentioned earlier, this book has really grown out of years' worth of research in our Metropolitan Opportunity Series. And Alan and I have been just so thankful for the wonderful and talented people we've gotten to work with over the years through that series. We've had colleagues and partners who've contributed research to the series, and we've met with countless practitioners, local leaders, people working on the ground on these issues in regions across the country. Many of those contributors are here with us today, and many are joining us online. But thank you to you all for your support and all that you've done to inform this work. And, of course, finally, thank you to all of you for joining us here today. And if you're joining us online, a couple housekeeping notes. If you'd like to follow along with the slides I'm going to be clicking through, there should be a link on the webcast page. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, as Strobe pointed out, you can join us with the hashtag #SuburbanPoverty, all one word. So to set the stage for today's discussion of the book and its findings, we wanted to share a brief video that our friends at Burness Communications put together. Hopefully, as you all were walking in here, you picked up a pen, which also has that website address on it. So when we're done here today, you can go home and check out all the resources we've put together on that site. But, you know, that video really encapsulates the reality that's facing regions across the country today. The landscape of poverty has changed. The rapid growth of the poor over the past decade has made suburbs home to the fastest growing and largest poor population in the country. But our perceptions and policies haven't kept pace with that change. To really tackle the challenge of suburban poverty nationwide, we need our policies and our programs to work in ways that fund more strategically, that collaborate across jurisdictions and across policy silos, and that work at a smarter scale to address the changing needs within regions. And that's our challenge as a nation. But to really understand these issues and all of the different kinds of communities they affect and how this is playing out across the country, the best way to really understand it is to look at this from the ground up. So take three regions, Chicago, Seattle, Houston, each different than the next, but each struggling with rapid increases in suburban poverty. And each of these regions are home to innovative organizations that have been working in these ways, funding strategically, collaborating, working at scale, to find innovative ways to address the changing needs in their region. So let's walk through these one by one, starting in Chicago. For decades, Chicago has been synonymous with urban poverty. The work of scholars like William Julius Wilson, with reporters and journalists like Alex Kotlowitz in inner city Chicago, really helped shape how Americans understand urban poverty and the devastating effects that can accompany concentrated disadvantage. But over the last decades, the suburbs in this region, where more than two-thirds of the residents of the region live, more than two-thirds of the jobs are located, these suburban communities have been increasingly struggling with the same kinds of challenges we've long associated with the city. They've dealt with a stagnant regional economy over the 2000s. They were also hit by some of the worst effects of the foreclosure crisis that followed the Great Recession. Overall, poverty in Chicago suburbs has grown by almost 99% in just over a decade. And it's now home to more of the region's poor than the city. Yet a lot of the suburban communities, more than 280 jurisdictions that surround the city, lack the kinds of capacity and infrastructure that the city has been able to build up over decades to deal with rapid increases in a growing poor population. We'll be hearing from Joe Neary later this morning. He's the CEO of IFF, formerly the Illinois Facilities Fund. IFF is a community development financial institution that started 25 years ago as a Chicago-based loan fund working with nonprofits that serve disadvantaged populations and communities. Since its start, IFF has grown to a $240 million multi-service organization that's operating across five Midwestern states. Today, IFF is helping to address gaps in capacity-strained suburbs by blending not only its financial capacity, but also nonprofit real estate development, technical assistance, research, and public policy expertise. With its in-house capacity, IFF is able to assess the changing needs of different communities within regions and leverage public and private dollars more effectively so they can stretch further to help more people in more places. Now let's consider Seattle. Compared to Chicago, this is a regional economy that has done better in recent years. And Seattle's suburbs in particular, the south side of King County, south of the city, they've long benefited from jobs, proximity to large employers like Boeing or the Port of Seattle. But these communities have also increasingly been home to a larger share of lower-paying jobs, and they too were hit hard by the Great Recession, where unemployment rose at faster rates and to higher levels than in the city of Seattle. And all of that economic change occurred against the backdrop of really rapid demographic transformation as well, particularly in the south suburbs. Drawn in part by the area's affordable housing stock, the south suburbs have seen an influx of residents from elsewhere in the region, where housing prices are higher, and from abroad, including both immigrant and refugee populations. Between 2000 and 2011, the poor population in Seattle suburbs grew by 79%, and it now is home to two-thirds of the region's poor population. South suburban school districts in particular have struggled with these rapid increases as they're trying to meet the needs of a growing and diversifying student population, which is now 58% low income and is comprised of students whose families speak 167 different languages. We'll be hearing from Mary Fertakis, director of the Tukwila Washington School Board. Tukwila, on the south side of Seattle, has come together with six other districts, including Seattle's south side, to form the Roadmap Project. They're working collectively together to reduce educational attainment gaps across the region and trying to better prepare students for colleges and careers in a high-tech economy like Seattle. Finally, suburban jurisdictions are often competing against each other, these communities are coming together in ways to collaborate and address shared challenges and devise shared solutions. Finally, consider the economic boomtown that is Houston, Texas. The idea of suburbs in this community is different than when we think of other places because, in part, the sprawling city itself feels so suburban. And, in fact, many of its newest suburbs are more recent developments. In the 2000s alone, the region added more residents than any other U.S. metropolitan area, and it now ranks among the most diverse in the region. It also added a lot of jobs, too, but many of those jobs were lower paying. And so families, even in those jobs, may be struggling to make ends meet. Between 2000 and 2011, the poor population in Houston's suburbs more than doubled, and it made the suburbs home to more of the region's poor than in the city for the first time. Now, there continue to be lots of job opportunities within the region, but its suburbs' growing low-income residents and its new immigrant populations need stronger connections to the kinds of skills and supports that would help them take advantage of those opportunities. And that's where Neighborhood Centers comes in. Our third panelist this morning will be Angela Blanchard, CEO of this $275 million social services agency. Neighborhood Centers operates across more than 60 sites in the city and suburbs of the region. It helps families and communities access social and economic opportunities by blending more than 35 different federal programs with state and local dollars and private investment to create a seamless continuum of services. At the same time, Neighborhood Centers invest in really understanding the different needs of the communities that it's serving. And because of its scale, it's able to target its services accordingly to meet this diverse array of needs, and at the same time find efficiency in its service delivery models. IFF, the Roadmap Project, Neighborhood Centers. All three of these organizations are finding smarter, more strategic ways to adapt to the changing geography of need in their regions. But in doing so, they've had to navigate a very fragmented system that's been built up in the 5 decades since we've declared a war on poverty. At the federal level alone, we spend $82 billion on place-based anti-poverty programs. But this funding is spread out across more than 80 programs and more than 10 agencies. What's more, these programs were largely built with distressed inner-city neighborhoods in mind, and they often prove inflexible and a poor match for the needs of today's suburbs. But organizations like the ones we're talking with today have found ways to blend these different funding streams with state, local, and private investment to create solutions that can do more than one thing in more than one place at the same time. They're cutting across city and suburban boundaries. They're cutting across policy silos. And so they are effectively playing regional quarterbacks, coordinating resources in ways that work more efficiently and more effectively region-wide. The current system doesn't make that easy, though. And in fact, it often gets in the way. And part of today's panel discussion, we'll be hearing from our panelists about the barriers that they face navigating the current system that's in place. And we'll also talk about some of the near-term practical solutions that policymakers, practitioners, and funders could take to clear the way for these types of solutions, not just to help these organizations in their work, but also for other regions to be able to adapt these types of strategies. But how do we go further to make these kinds of strategies that we're seeing in Chicago and Seattle and Houston the norm? To really change the system in ways that work better for more people and more places over the long term, it's going to take more than just short-term strategies. If we repurpose just 5% of what we currently spend at the federal level on place-based poverty alleviation strategies, we could repurpose $4 billion for what we call a Metropolitan Opportunity Challenge. This would be structured as a competitive funding stream and offer real incentives to states and regions to think differently about how resources are deployed within regions and evaluate what's really working to increase access to economic opportunities for low-income people and communities in cities and in suburbs alike, whether those opportunities are related to better schools, to services, or to jobs. Now, not every region has an IFF or a roadmap project or neighborhood centers to play the regional quarterback, but a Metropolitan Opportunity Challenge can catalyze the kind of capacity in regions across the country. The initial $4 billion could leverage private investment and realign other funding sources so that we would have a truly transformative impact. But we also know that we can't wait for the federal government to act. And that's why we'll be traveling around the country for the next several months, highlighting innovative models like the ones we're featuring here today in regions across the country, encouraging those regions to work in more scaled, collaborative, and strategic ways that promote opportunity for urban and suburban communities alike. And by demonstrating and adapting what's working, smart local and regional leaders can eventually push state and federal policy into the 21st century. As Luis mentioned, next year will mark the 50th anniversary of President Johnson declaring a war on poverty. We've learned a great deal over the last 5 decades from the successes and the failures that emerged from that war. But today, challenges are growing and our resources are shrinking. We don't have another 50 years to recreate the urban poverty playbook in suburbia. The need is too pressing and the playbook is outdated. So will we continue business as usual and risk limiting the future economic potential of millions of Americans and their communities because we didn't adapt to today's challenges? Or 50 years from today, can we look back and say this was the moment we confronted poverty in a new way that works better for people and places no matter where they are? We hope this new book can help frame those critical questions here in Washington and in regions across the country. And thank you again for coming to be here, be a part of this discussion today. I'd be happy to take some questions.
Hi, Diane Silber, clinical psychologist. It seems to me there are two types of poverty in the suburbs, those inner city fleeing the city or being forced out, and the people who have dropped out of the middle class due to this recession, depression. I just want to know if your approaches apply to both and if you see any differences. I would imagine education is one. Some are coming with more education than the other.
That's absolutely right, that when we see suburban poverty growing in regions across the country, it's generally because of two factors. Either lower-income families and residents are moving in, or longer-term residents have been slipping down the economic ladder. Usually both of those dynamics are at play. Our strategies and recommendations we're suggesting in the book and here today are really about however you came to be in the suburbs, however you came to be low-income. These strategies create a more flexible and resource-efficient approach to addressing those needs and barriers that may keep you from accessing the kind of opportunities that could help a family get on more stable economic footing. And in fact, that's why we would say it's not even that these are suburban solutions. This is really about moving the system forward in a way that works better for more people in places, urban, suburban, and rural communities alike, would benefit from a flexible system like this. And please do identify yourself before you ask your question.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a physician. I'm 16 years older than the gentleman from the Ford Foundation, and I remember the war on poverty very well. Lots of my generation participated in it. Things have changed a lot, not just for poor people, but the political situation in this country. Some of our best anti-poverty programs, like WIC, and food stamps, now called SNAP, are under assault, have been cut in the sequester, and they're planning to cut them again. Have you taken into consideration in making your plans the enormous change in political attitude since 1964?
Yeah, I think that the kind of system that we are talking about today is something that should appeal across the aisle, because what we're saying is evaluate what works and invest in that. We know we have a shrinking pool of resources, and cuts are being made in Washington as we speak to these programs. If we do that in a way that's not thoughtful about the long-term implications, we do risk creating deeper, more entrenched challenges in these communities that could have been avoided. So by taking this opportunity today to really assess what's working and really invest in outcome-driven, data-driven solutions, thinking about how do we make money stretch further, this really should be something that not only improves outcomes for everyone, but should be something that both political parties should be able to sign on to.
Hi, I'm John Franklin from United Way of Northern New Jersey, and maybe because I'm from Jersey, I'm real sensitive to this. We're expecting the possibility of some mass displacement because of climate change. And I wonder if you've thought about that in your research.
I mean, the way that those sorts of environmental and disaster-related crises occur absolutely affect the spatial aspects of poverty and how we even go about addressing it, whether we have the systems in place that can meet those rapidly shifting needs. We've seen that in regions like New Orleans. We've seen that in regions like Houston, which Angela can speak to. And it's even more incentive to really be able to have a more scaled approach that can have the array of services at hand to quickly adapt to these changing needs as people move from places or are displaced without their control. And I'm sure that Angela can talk to that more later today.
I'm Kyle Farnbury. I'm Associate Dean of the Graduate School at Rutgers University in Newark. I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit more about the roadshow that you were hinting towards. What are sort of the outcomes? What types of partnerships are you looking to build? And what ultimately is going to be the impact that you're hoping to have from that time?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And also, visit www.confrontingsuburbanpoverty.org. We'll be updating it regularly with our events throughout the coming year. But we're targeting a number of regions where we're working with partners on the ground. And really the idea is not just to come do a book release event, but to really engage with people working on these issues on the ground and find ways to highlight what issues are critical in these regions and what good work is going on to help move that forward. So that it should really help spark a policy discussion among local and regional leaders that can move action forward, whether this is a region that may be starting the conversation for a first time, beginning to think about these things across city and suburban lines, or a place like the regions we'll hear about today, which are each already well on the path, but still need the help and the right incentives and the right policy reforms to help scale up their work and move them forward. So again, we will be updating that on the website throughout the year and making all those resources available. Okay, one more question.
Elizabeth, I'm Roberta Actenberg, and my question is, I know that the federal government is not the primary focus of the policy prescriptions that are contained in the book. Nonetheless, they could be a potent actor if they were so inclined. Would you talk a little bit about what you're intending to do to influence the development of policy by the various departments and the White House specifically? Mm-hmm.
I think that is an excellent point. If we had something like a Metropolitan Opportunity Challenge, that could be transformative. But understanding that that may not be the first step in making this change happen, we have really powerful leaders on the local level already doing this. And if we could pilot the way something like this works, show the good work on the ground, and send that up the chain, then hopefully we can lead by example, as regions are already beginning to do, and move federal policy in line with these efforts. But, of course, throughout our rollout process, we'll be continuing to get this information out there and want to be showing exactly what works in regions across the country. And thank you all very much. With that, I will turn the stage over to Alan Berube, who will introduce our panelists.
So my name is Alan Berube. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings, and more importantly, I'm Elizabeth's co-author. I'm very proud about that fact and so pleased to have been part of this venture for the last several years. So I want to start, of course, with an advertisement, which is to buy the book. It is available outside. It is a real tangible thing. This is in the electronic age, as Stroh was mentioning. This is hard to believe. I actually got a thing last week in a box, and it had my name on it and Elizabeth's name too. So I hope you all will take the advantage of buying it, or you can download it onto your Kindle or iPad or what have you. We will sign it if you like, unless you're afraid that would devalue it. We won't do that. Once again, I'll advertise our website, which is confrontingsuburbanpoverty.org. We've put together a whole host of materials that, if you don't want to read the whole book, extract some of the real tangible value out of that, and hope to spread some of this research and messages across the country. If you forget the website, it's on the side of the pens. You can get a pen outside, too. There's a lot of swag going on here. And then finally, you can keep the conversation going today on Twitter, hashtag suburbanpoverty, one word. Okay, so I may have the most challenging job of the day, which is to expose everyone here and on the webcast to the brilliance of our three panelists and do it under 1 hour. And I won't do them justice, but I hope you can get a glimpse of what they know and the value that they're providing their communities today and around these issues, starting today on the national level. I won't give you their full bios in light of our limited time here. You can find them in your packets, but I'll say a word about each of them in the process of asking the first question. Finally, I want to say that Elizabeth and I, over the process of writing this book over a few years, we visited a lot of regions around the country, some of the dots that you saw on the map earlier there. And when it came time to pick three people for this panel, three organizations and three places that really represented what we regarded to be innovation on this issue, it took us about 15 seconds, I'd say. Unfortunately, none of those people could be here today, so we got these three. I'm joking. This is exactly who we thought of. So with that, I want to talk here with Joe Neary from IFF, Mary Fertakis from the Tukwila School Board in Washington, and Angela Blanchard from Neighborhood Centers in Houston. So I want to begin the discussion by helping our audience understand a little bit about the communities in which you all work, What sorts of changes you've actually seen going on there over the past decade or more, to the extent you can do that in 2 or 3 minutes each, that'd be great. So maybe, Mary, I could start with you on this question. So you serve, as I said, as the director of the school board for Tukwila, Washington. It's a city of about 20,000 people, I think, just on the south side of Seattle. You also recently served as the president of the Washington State School Directors Association. So you have a lot of experience in thinking about these issues from a statewide level and a policy level as well. So if you would, could you paint sort of a brief portrait of Tukwila and some of the communities in South King County, the changes that are taking place and what that's meant for schools there in particular?
Thank you, Alan. I'd be happy to share. Tukwila and the Roadmap region is, as you heard a little bit earlier, an extremely diverse community. It's not official, but we're a refugee immigrant resettlement area. So coming to Tukwila is the first stop for many of the families that we serve. And Tukwila itself is only about 3,000 students, and we have over 70 languages spoken, if you can imagine, and over 60% of our student body who do not speak English as their first language, coming from wherever you've read about. Basically, in sum, if you've read about something in the paper happening internationally, in all likelihood, students from that country will be in our school district within 10 months. So our latest influx has been from Burma, Bhutan, and Nepal. And so we fluctuate back and forth on who's coming in and what their needs are. And it's extremely challenging, but it's also a really beautiful thing that happens because there's not a majority of any particular group. And so for my own children, they've had a very unique experience. I'm Caucasian, but my Caucasian children are minorities. My son is a senior at our local high school, and he represents about 18% of the student population. And for as a student who actually speaks English as his first language and Caucasian, that's about 15%. That just gives you an idea of what that's like. The changes that we've seen, it's really become a majority-minority school district in a very short period of time and is reflective of what's happening in our region. You can, when Alan came out to visit, one of the things that they saw on the wall of our high school are all of the homecoming queens and queens and kings for a number of years. And in 1990, we had the first homecoming queen of color. And it is such a stark line from prior to that to what has happened this year. And this year's homecoming queen and king were from Ethiopia and Bosnia. So it's a really graphic depiction of what's happening. Again, challenges, but at the same time, so many assets because of our size and the fact that we are now working collaboratively, which I know we'll get into a little bit more, but this just gives you a bit of an idea of what our region is looking like.
That's terrific. Thanks, Mary. Maybe I could turn to Angela next. You represent a region of growing diversity as well. You're president and CEO of Neighborhood Centers. It's the largest nonprofit in Texas. They do everything bigger in Texas, so that's saying something if you're the biggest one. You serve about 400,000 people each year throughout the region, over 60 locations, a really wide range of services and support. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the places that you're serving across that region, both urban and suburban, and whether you think there are really any important distinctions between your city locations and your suburban locations in terms of the needs and challenges there.
Thanks. Well, first, I can't tell you how wonderful it is to be here in D.C. and hear a conversation open with nice things being said about somebody we elected in Texas. So it is 50 years old, but still, the news was good. I think the most surprising thing for folks outside of Houston is learning that our city became the nation's most diverse city. So, and it didn't become the most diverse city by having people arrive from all over the world, just like Mary's story, all over the world, filled with aspirations and settling squarely in the center of Houston. They came and they settled everywhere that housing was affordable. And so when I was asked recently, what's the difference between the suburbs, the work you're doing in the suburbs, versus the work you're doing in the immigrant community? I said, well, if you've been in Houston, then you know Houston is an immigrant community. Our region is a vast magnet for people with aspirations that who believe that through their own hard work, their hopes and dreams can be realized. So the most important part of today's presentation for me is the discussion about how people are connected out of neighborhoods into those larger regional opportunities. Because you might be generating the jobs as we are in Texas. You might be providing what you can in terms of the market-related opportunities. But if people are cut off from those, isolated in any way, then those jobs will go unfilled and the poverty will persist. So we are an economic powerhouse in Houston. We are proud of that. We worked for it. What we want, though, is that promise that we make in this country to be realized in Houston, to be connected to each neighborhood that we serve, all 73 of them. So I think that this is a powerful book. I think there's a couple of really brave people to take on geography, demographics, and economy all in one book, and to look at the nexus of that. So it's a very, hugely useful book, and we thank you for it.
Thanks, Angela. Brave or foolish, depending upon how you look at it. That's terrific. Joe,
Time will tell.
That's right. Joe, so you're CEO of IFF, as Elizabeth described, formerly the Illinois Facilities Fund. I joke, I don't know if this is just my joke, it's like KFC, right? It used to be Kentucky Fried Chicken, now it's just, that's just KFC. You're a little healthier than they are, I think.
Formerly known as.
But you do a lot of different things, right? You are a strategic advisor, you're a real estate developer, you're a community development financier for affordable housing, charter schools, child care facilities. And you've been active now in cities and suburbs across 5 different states in the Midwest. So I'm wondering what you see through your work that maybe puts this suburban issue into a broader context. We sort of went from one community to one region, and now you're in a whole bunch of regions. And so I'm wondering how you're seeing this in the places where you work.
So we do play over a 5-state space, and there's just so many similarities between a Chicago, a St. Louis, a Milwaukee, an Indianapolis, a Kansas City. And those cities and metropolitan areas all have so much more in common than they do because you're in Illinois or Indiana or Wisconsin. A lot of our deepest work is done in Chicago. And Chicago is a meld of a couple of the things that we discussed, right? There's this push as we rethink public housing in the city of Chicago, and we encourage people to go find jobs. And many of the jobs were in the suburbs of the Chicago metropolitan area. And so people began to move out to where employment was. And that obviously raised a number of challenges. But the second part of that was we have immigrants also in Chicago, many in the Latino community. They started by a port of entry really in the city of Chicago and then began to expand out following jobs, but now directly move new immigrants coming directly to those communities. But what they find, and this is true in St. Louis, this is true in Milwaukee, what they find is there's no infrastructure that really deals with some of the issues that they have. We got so involved in this over 10, 12 years ago in work around early education, where some of the greatest need in the Chicago metropolitan area was not in the city of Chicago, but we're in suburbs all around the metropolitan area. And in some ways, Mary talks about this, it's the school districts were the canaries in the coal mine, because they were getting kids into the kindergarten, first and second grade without any kind of Head Start prep or early ed prep, but also really dealing with the fact that they just hadn't built any infrastructure. So our work was really about beginning that process, and that plays out in upper education, it plays out in healthcare, and it certainly plays out in the whole human services safety net.
For any of you, it sounds like what you were seeing in your regions was present long before the recession. Has the recession changes, it just magnified it, and what do you think is going to happen when the recovery sets in? Is this structural? Is it cyclical? How do you view it?
The recession definitely had an impact. I mean, the changes were taking place. Mm-hmm. We were trying to establish some support networks for the different groups coming in, getting better at how to work with the different ethnic groups and different cultures and needs. And then the recession really did have a major impact. One of the things we've seen in our area, in our school district, we are at almost 9% homeless for our students. Those are students we can identify, so we know it's higher than that. And homelessness brings up a whole other set of issues that you have to address related to housing and transportation and health and human services and all of the other things that families are dealing with when you're in that type of a situation. The other thing we found is that while we've always had a high mobility rate, in fact, what happened was people were combining together living in a house so that they could meet the mortgage. So in my particular neighborhood, it's not at all unusual to see 6, 7, or 8 cars in the driveway, and it makes it very difficult to then predict how many students are going to be coming in. There's no formula that's a 2.2 per house that we can go off of. Yeah. What we're starting to see, though, is with the recovery is that now that housing prices are starting to go up a little bit, it's now going to cause the mobility to go up because people are going to be priced out again.
So let me turn to what it is you all do. So we've advanced this notion today in the conversation in the book that you all are doing something different maybe than what's going on in the rest of America, something that's a little bit more scaled to the magnitude of the issues facing cities and suburbs today. So I want to, A, find out if that's true, and then B, get you to talk about a little bit about what that something is that's different and that maybe we all should be looking at a little bit more carefully as to how we bring that to other places. So, Angela, your organization's, I guess it's a century old now or maybe more, largest nonprofit in Texas, but it wasn't like that when you started. So how did you reach the scale that you're at today? What did it take to be effective as you grew for the communities that you're trying to serve? And what's important about the scale that you have today for meeting the goals of your organization and your communities? That's a small question. Where do you start? Yeah.
So actually, here's really at the heart of the story is one has to think about what does it take to really build an evolutionary organization? Because organizations, human services organizations that are married to, tied to, committed to one service, one locale, one demographic, one project, tend to organize to hang on to that. And when the world changes and the geography shifts and the economy is different, then that process of working and evolving with it is hard to do. So what does it take to be evolutionary in a siloed world in which every policy, every funding source, every grant is written for a particular locale, for a particular demographic, for one dimension of what it takes to create neighborhoods of opportunity for people? It takes a lot of hard work. You got to milk every cow, right? I'm going to try to class that up a little bit. Really, you have to learn to work with all of the siloed funding sources and policies. You have to take anything that's available, put it together in a way. It's a bit of alchemy within the organization in a way that really meets the needs for the people that whose potential you want to have realized. One of the other things that we're being noticed for a lot is an extremely important shift from a perspective on poor neighborhoods as places where we study problems, analyze those problems, and roll out a fix. So to be an evolutionary organization, you have to be fed by the aspirations of the people that you're trying to reach. So we see people not as the problems, poverty not as the problem, but people as the resource and the potential that has to be realized. So the whole region moves forward. One of the other commitments you have to make, and this is a leadership commitment, it's an organizational commitment, is you're going to have to do this longer than anybody's going to fund you for it. Somebody's going to go in with you. They're not going to be there for the day that neighborhood is completely changed and transformed. You have to be in it for the long haul, and you have to stick with it. And as the funding changes and the what becomes popular, we're all about place-based. That has about another minute and a half, and then we'll be about something else. But in reality, every neighborhood needs a school where people are proud to send their children. Everyone needs a financial institution they trust. You want a clinic you can go to. Let's don't imagine that poor neighborhoods have to be studied, have to be worked with in some radically different way. What we have to do is take all the siloed ways that things are supported and put them together to create the same kind of neighborhood for people, low-income families, that all families want to live in. And so I think that's what people are noticing more, that we've figured out how to take all this siloed funding and craft something more holistic and more integrated.
This notion of the evolutionary organization, right, and the folks who are committed to doing more than one thing in more than one place over time is, when Elizabeth talked about the quarterback, I mean, pick your favorite metaphor. It's a quarterback, it's an orchestra conductor, it's a sweeper.
That one is completely lost on me. Yeah. No aptitude for sports, but
that's you, right.
I take it it's a good thing to be a quarterback.
It is. And I think, Joe, I think you're aiming to be that sort of quarterback, that evolutionary organization as well. And again, when you started 25 years ago, you were a small community loan fund in Chicago. So tell us a little bit about your evolution, sort of what pushed you in these new communities and to what Angela was talking about, how you be scaled and yet local and rooted in local places at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about that challenge very specifically. So our evolutions, we were a $2 million loan fund, and we really were developed to meet the capital needs of nonprofits. And we built that organization on that principle for a number of years. But what we found considerably was that capital was just part of a solution. And so if you didn't have an agency that was growing in a community, say childcare in the suburbs, nobody was coming to you for an application for capital. So we evolved into also becoming a real estate development company for nonprofits, or a CDC, if you will, for nonprofit organizations, to assist them to kind of plan, conceptualize, and think about developing infrastructure for serving communities of need. And part of that evolutionary process after that was, well, okay, so you can do that. Where's the greatest need? And that really brought us very deeply into this question about suburban poverty, because so much of the need seemingly was in the city of Chicago, when in fact it was all over the metropolitan area. And so we developed a research group to begin analysis in terms of thinking about need in a different way across multiple spaces. Early education was part of that. Now we do a lot around school performance. The numbers in Chicago are staggering when you move into the suburbs and look at city performance in many of the inner ring suburbs. The schools actually perform much worse than some of the worst schools in Chicago, but yet the bright light of Chicago drowns out that. It just creates so much noise. Mm-hmm. So we've evolved into a place, as Angela said, we have to think comprehensively. It can't just be childcare. It can't just be affordable housing. Much of that, the community development world that we exist was all about affordable housing and economic development. IFF actually grew out of a place of human services, education, healthcare, and later evolved into affordable housing and economic development. So we've kind of met in the middle. And if we think about healthy communities, strong communities, as Angela just said, it has all of those components. So our job is to be able to be nimble enough to have capital to make it happen, have technical expertise to make it happen, but also to be informed by facts. Because I think Luis was talking so eloquently, is that if we're not dealing with facts, it gets very difficult to use very scarce resources wisely.
Yeah, and one of our dirty little secrets is that Elizabeth did that with you guys. Yes. She worked for IFF many years ago.
But on the scale issue, we're a financial institution. Scale is very important, and the CDFIs have grown significantly across the country. But it takes scale to work in that space, and so we were the Illinois Facilities Fund. We became IFF because we expanded to a number of states. And have grown to be a significant financial institution, but it gives us the power to really pull funds, not just from government. In fact, our government funding is very small, but it's a unique program, the CDFI Fund, because it's small, very small amounts of money that leverage very large amounts of private capital. So we really look at that as a smart government investment that pulls in other capital, but it's done best at scale.
Yeah. And scale is something I want to come to you around, Mary, too, because there's no, I mean, not to my knowledge at least, you don't have a Angela or a Joe working in South King County, Washington. You guys have tried to find scale in a different way by getting together in this initiative that Elizabeth alluded to called the Roadmap Project. It's a collaboration, a collective action project among six suburban school districts plus the city of Seattle public schools. Is that as unnatural an act as it sounds like? And what got you all there to that same table on the search of a sort of shared goal setting and solutions?
I'm really glad you asked, and I do want to say that we do have a quarterback. I have to give some props to Mary Jean Ryan, who is the executive director of CCER and who I really credit with pulling this together. Her background was she was a policy director for the mayor of Seattle and had a lot of connections and seeing what the issues were from an urban setting and having a bigger vision for looking at data. I mean, the data is so compelling for the needs. King County, for those of you who are not familiar with it, at the north and east end of it, that's home of Microsoft's corporate headquarters. And then you've got South King County on the other end of the spectrum. And so the gap in the same county where you're 25, 30 minutes away is, it's staggering when you look at the resources and what's there. So I do consider her a quarterback, but what has happened is that there were a lot of people out there and organizations seeing the issues, mm-hmm. But we didn't have a way to come under together as an umbrella, like a neighborhood centers. So the amazing thing to me is we really just launched in 2010, in the middle of the recession. But we got together with the superintendents of the seven school districts and the community college presidents meet monthly, and they're streamlining the process for our high school students to be able to get into the community colleges. The school boards in the seven districts have all signed resolutions supporting this, the mayors of our cities. I mean, it's truly a collective impact project where we have work groups looking at cradle to career. And people who are drawn and passionate about and have training, or not necessarily, they're interested in the different areas, birth to third grade, K through 12, ELL, data, high school to college transition, parent engagement. All of those work groups exist, and it's for me, it's exciting because each time we have a quarterly meeting, there are more people there who are being drawn in as there's a way that they can take their passion and what resources they have within their organizations or the networks they have to contribute to what is a very exciting element. And yes, it is non-intuitive on some levels, but for me, because I've been a school board director for 18 years, and it's become very clear to me that I can have the best policies in the world, but I'm not going to get the educational attainment I want for my students and their academic success unless the policies related to housing, transportation, human services are in alignment so that the kids walking in my door aren't having to worry about where they're going to sleep that night and where the next meal's coming from, and they can actually be there because they don't have a chronic toothache that's contributing to an absentee rate. All of those things have to take place for schools to be able to accomplish their mission at a high level. So for me, seeing that and looking at our mobility along the Interstate 5 corridor, the kids are moving back and forth across our district lines. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, those lines are fairly arbitrary, and we have to look at all of our students as our kids. Yeah. And as soon as you take that perspective that these are our kids, no matter which district they're in, if we're committed to their success and their family success, you're going to do what the Roadmap Project is doing.
Right, yeah. So I'm glad you're bridging us to an important sort of policy conversation. So I'd like to ask you all, maybe you need to just suspend disbelief for a minute and imagine that Washington was actually poised to do something other than hold hearings about the IRS or leaks or whatever. What if we wanted to make the sorts of changes that you're making in your communities more the norm rather than the exception in terms of how we address poverty in cities and suburbs across the country? I want to sort of get your thoughts about what that would, you know, what you're experiencing on the other end, and then sort of what that would look like to turn it into a more coherent system. So maybe I could start with you, Joe, and Angela already talked about the silos, and I know you see the silos from where you're sitting as well. Is the scale and the ability to knit these things together in a creative way to blend technical assistance and research and strategic advice and financing and development, is that something that you feel like federal or state policy really values? Is it something they could value more explicitly, and how would you like to see them do that?
Well, I do think that theoretically, they certainly would value it. And I think that the whole conversation in community development is moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some promising programs coming out of HUD that is trying to weave those things together. But some of the most exciting things, I think, is Mary's roadmap project is about bringing jurisdictions together. And in Chicago, the Metropolitan Planning Council brought five municipalities to work together around affordable housing. And the programs are just not, they're not made to work across five municipalities. They're not, you were telling me a story about, you know, three groups coming together, and the work is all about, has to be done on an individual basis. So I think that one area where federal policy and state policy really could start to move is to encourage this kind of collaboration, because the challenge working in the suburbs is, in Chicago, we're dealing with 290 of them, yeah, right? So when they collaborate and work together, which creates a scale for something like affordable housing, and hopefully we'd like to expand this more kind of ideas around community development, and certain, and of course in education, you shouldn't be penalized. And yeah, I think that that's one of the, that's, that is a policy change that doesn't cost a lot of money, if anything, that could really kind of move this conversation forward.
Yeah, some of these, right, and we chronicle some of this in the book, and it's just, it's strange and perverse, but I don't know, you've been at it for a while, you see this too, Angela, right? I mean, what are the costs, the sort of human and financial costs associated with trying to deal with the 35 programs and the 40 different data systems? What could be done to make those processes easier, short of just like cutting Angela Blanchard a big check for her to do God's work with?
So I was imagining if Washington actually got to work and tried to simplify things for us, and I pictured, you know, when that happens, for example, with tax policy, when Washington makes it, you know, simplified, how much more difficult it gets. So I'm terrified of answering this question. And for fear that something would get done, we've just now figured out how to work with all of this. And if you improve it, heaven help us. So I think, let me just tell you, this is the challenge, this is the urgency I feel. If I'm someone living on $32,000 a year for my family in a suburb of Houston today, and I have the jobs, more than what it takes to assemble that amount of income, I cannot wait for anything that's going to happen here, or anything that's going to happen in the way of policy, or anything that's going to happen at the national level in a national foundation for my future, because it's not coming in time. And when it arrives, it won't be pinpointed and targeted the way it would work best. That's sadly true. So the value of having strong organizations is to figure out how to use what will come and to make that work. And I think those points get made in the book. Yes, we pay a really high price to feed bureaucracy data that no one ever looks at. What we long for is if the federal government acted as a value investor, and we could say the three things the people are working for the hardest: to increase their income, to see their children succeed at school, to belong and be connected to their neighbors. Now, we measure those because that's what the people we work with care about. Judge us on that. Fund us or not when we achieve or don't achieve that. We imagine a world in which we sit before people asked to deliver the thing that matters most to the people that we work with, and that we're rewarded with doing more work if we get it done. Now, in the meantime, there's somebody in a neighborhood in Houston who came to our region with hopes and dreams, believing that the best place to plant those was right there in Houston, Texas. And our job is to connect them, whatever it takes. I recently listened to a national foundation, and I will have to say, I think in every way, many communities in this country feel overlooked. It is so precious to me to see the work that Brookings has done around this map of what our city now looks like, because all of the other maps of where you invest to help people never looked anything like our city. So a million times we were overlooked for support when we really needed it. And so I thank you for that, because we've got this new map now, and I think it's going to help us as we go forward. So I think changes. Mm-hmm. Make value investments. Hold us accountable for things that matter. If we've been doing it decades and it's turned out well, give us a break on the 90 million reports that we churn out that no one ever looks at. Those are dreams. In the meantime, we really do have to make it work. And that means working together and building strong collaborative relationships and putting the goals and the aspirations of the people we serve right at the center of the work.
Is there, Mary, is there something about the roadmap project and the recent race to the top district competition where you received a significant grant? I mean, is there a silver lining here? Is it that kind of outcome-focused, you know, valuing sort of collaboration and real goal-setting coming out of the Department of Education? Is that, do you feel like it's getting at some of these issues that Joe and Angela are identifying? And is it a model for how we could address other policy arenas like housing or transportation?
The simple answer is yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
definitely Angela's point about the bureaucracy, the reports, that takes a lot of time. And we hear a lot about accountability, particularly in schools. But what's forgotten is that accountability is supposed to be two-way.
Yeah.
And the accountability at this point is it's on the schools. But there's some accountability from the federal government and our state governments to also be making this investment in our children and in our communities by adequate funding. So that part I haven't seen that much of.
Mm-hmm.
I see declining resources and increased demands for the reporting. And as you mentioned very eloquently in the book, a lot of the rules seem to be made for the 1% that isn't doing what they're supposed to. And the 99% of us sitting here and listening to the webcast and in other places who are trying to do the work, yeah. It's like, why are these barriers being put up and impeding sincere efforts to try and improve communities?
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the Race to the Top grant, there is no denying that resources matter. And getting a $40 million grant for the seven of us to do three things that we've identified, which is we're calling it Start Strong, which is a focus on birth to third grade, Stay Strong, which is the high school to college career transition, and STEM Strong, because we really want to be able to tap into all of the wonderful job opportunities related to STEM fields. So the excitement around that is we already had the work plans in place. It was now how are we going to do it? So to have that infusion is really exciting for all of us to be able to figure out how we can collaborate even more. So don't let anyone tell you that resources aren't important. They are. And again, there are probably ways to make things perhaps more efficient, and some collaborative efforts can definitely help that. But my main point would be, before you do these policies, talk to the people who are actually going to be implementing them and the ones who are on the ground who will be doing the work.
Because
mm-hmm. you can have a great policy over here, and you can have a great outcome you want, but this piece in the middle with the implementation is where everything happens, and it's going to be successful or not, if based on the actual involvement of those doing the work.
Yeah, and I think one could argue that kind of consultation and discovery is even more important in the context of some of the communities that you're all working in and a part of. They may have assumptions about how this stuff works, informed by 50 years of waging the war on poverty in cities,
yeah.
and have very little understanding of what this stuff looks like in a suburban municipality that actually doesn't really have a housing department or doesn't really have a social services function. Does that resonate with you? Do they make assumptions about how things work in your places that are really at odds with the kinds of places these are?
Yeah, I think the assumptions get made about how they work and also about how they ought to work, and
yeah.
neither of those things applies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, people have asked me, for example, what's the difference between how you work in suburban communities versus how you work in immigrant communities? Well, that would be one and the same. So not that we work the same, but those are one and the same
mm-hmm.
in Houston. So I think that old map really needs to be set aside. And really, we waged a war on poverty that talked about what we did not want. I think that the conversation that this book can spawn is about what we do want. Mm-hmm. And really, that is a stronger system of connections, a more integrated approach, a way literally of having someone living in a neighborhood being able to reach those broader opportunities. So we have to keep talking about how that bridge gets built, mm-hmm. and it needs to be built from both ends. So one important point, we can't finance what we want to do the way we finance the old programs. I said, so new financing models, what Joe is talking about, what Joe's done, the new financing models are essential. All money's not created equal. And so money, the real leverage off of private sector money, when you can put public sector, private sector, and nonprofit together, that three-legged stool actually achieves a great deal more that is sustainable than any one of those legs or any one silo. So those are things I think that are that financing for and how it looks when it really works is something worth looking at as well, and getting the leverage off the enormously important private support that is generally speaking not always somewhat more flexible and responsive, and that's a very worthwhile thing to come back to, because all these dreams don't happen if the money doesn't flow the way
it would. I completely say, this is the ability to federal money, move it out of government into the hands of intermediaries who have to be accountable for it. So leverage, on a leveraging side, but to be able to use it in ways that are meaningful locally. And there are many programs, actually, that Washington does that actually fit this bill. I mean, the Department of Education has this little, tiny little program called the Credit Enhancement Program for Charter School. I mean, it's so small, it is a rounding error on a good day. And yet, this money goes out to intermediaries, CDFIs, some state associations, and they use it to credit enhance kind of some private Wall Street bond debt, et cetera. Myriad ways, all that are vital for that locality. So our $12 million that we've put into this program has already been leveraged to $220 million worth of charter facilities. So there are so many ways for Washington to move money on an innovative basis. And I do think that this bridges this conversation of the gridlock in Washington, because it is about outcomes, it is about leveraging, it is about collaboration that isn't done in a smart way. But if that same program was, you shall do this, it won't work in the same way in Chicago, Houston, and Seattle. Clearly I think we have got to think about flexibility to get that, to use scale, but be very local. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And I'm always appreciative when you help us define our future research agenda, too. So so a real focus on these issues, I think, must be the next wave of what we do. I just want to take about maybe 10 minutes for questions. Let's go to I'll introduce him, George McCarthy from the Ford Foundation. Hey, Mac.
Thanks, Alan. I'm George McCarthy from the Ford Foundation. And so I want to go back to a point Alan made a little bit ago where he kind of described at least the Seattle experience, but I would say probably all of you, as kind of unnatural occurrences. Because one of the things that that I think we're confronting here is the fact that, especially in the nonprofit community, it's not driven by an evolutionary logic that, like, drives market-based institutions. And so then the question becomes, what is it that drives the evolution of organizations that, for some reason, voluntarily choose to change their focus from narrow geographies to broader geographies? And I'm wondering also why it is that we haven't talked at all about regional planning as being an element in driving that evolution, because in some ways, the experiment the Obama administration started with the Sustainable Communities Initiative is one way for us to begin to kind of explode geography and say maybe we have to think differently about our institutional arrangements to deal with whatever the problems are we're trying to deal with. I don't know. We haven't been discussing that yet today.
Well, yeah. So maybe that is a question. Is there anything about the way that the federal government has been acting more recently that has been part of this evolutionary process of your organizations and your initiatives, specifically around regional planning issues? And if the answer is no, that's
awkward
okay.
Silence.
So we're working in those five communities that I discuss as five suburban community inner ring suburbs, and we received a sustainable communities grant, and it was actually made because there was a collaboration amongst different communities. We are focused around kind of transit-oriented development. There's a number of train lines that go through a serious foreclosure crisis in these communities. So IFF, is operating a program to think theoretically on a planning basis of using the collaboration, doing the foreclosure rehabilitation around all of the transit-oriented space, creating a transit-oriented development fund that will then fund further affordable housing in and around those communities. And it's working fairly well. Now, the challenge is that the planners in HUD are fabulous on the grand idea, but when we get to then the finance side of what we do, this TOD fund, it's I don't want to say it's a nightmare. But it's a lot of like wanting to prescribe each and every piece of this financing because they don't necessarily have an understanding of finance. So we do have to challenge ourselves to be more interdisciplinary. We're doing it. And we need government to be able to do that also. So, and that can be very challenging. I go back to that Department of Ed program. The Department of Ed doesn't do any finance of stuff. But they very specifically worked with some consultants to create out a framework for how finance should be. But ultimately, it was all about outcomes. Give us leverage. Do charter schools. Do it quickly. And if you do those things, we don't care how you arrange the interest rates or how you use the credit enhancement or whether you do bonds or whether you do new markets tax credits. We don't care. Get us the leverage. It's a beautiful, simple program that then has had a huge, huge outcomes across the country.
And Mary, was there any history of real collaboration among the municipalities in South King County prompted by planning or any other policy imperative?
Well, we had a potential impending disaster that had everyone, the Howard Hanson Dam, which had was having some issues, and had that flooded the valley, that would have been an economic disaster for this entire country. People don't realize how much takes place in that valley. So the municipalities did work together on some emergency prep, and that was also in the last couple of years. So some of those relationships were there. So we're all adjacent, but again, as it's mentioned in the book, you know, municipalities have their own thing. School districts have their own thing. And if nothing else, the recession has made it very clear that we can't continue operating that way. The resources will probably never be the way they were before, and the only way we're really going to meet community or regional goals is if we are developing those types of collaborations. Unfortunately, sometimes it does take something negative to happen to promote what is the Chinese thing about crisis and opportunity. It's the same character. And I would say that, unfortunately, that may be the way things have to happen. But I also think that in Washington, and because I'm 3,000 miles away, I guess I can say this, things that should be pretty basic, which is not the same as easy, get lost. And I'll take an example of housing. If the student that starts with me on the first day of school is there with me the last day of school, you have just addressed a ton of issues. Mm-hmm. Why can we not have policies to have that one thing happen? It's basic. It might not be easy, but those are the kinds of things that need to happen. So I guess it'd be nice to just have people look at, you know, here are the things, here's the outcome we really want, and is there the collective will to get there? Yeah. I mean, these wonderful people are doing it in their communities. It's possible. It shouldn't be the exception.
Maybe take another question back there.
Yeah. Greg Squires from George Washington University. I also grew up in the eastern suburbs of Cleveland in the 50s and 60s and later spent several years on the board of the Woodstock Institute in Chicago. It seems to me poverty was never more invisible than when it was even more concentrated in central cities, and suburban commuters drove downtown to their downtown jobs on expressway, bypassing these communities altogether. And it's still today that poverty is much higher in central cities than it is the suburbs. So my question to anybody in the panel is, what do you think of the merits or demerits of programs like GATRO or Moving to Opportunity or the Mount Laurel program, other efforts to try to help low-income folks move to low poverty, high opportunity neighborhoods, often in the suburban ring?
Well, I'll speak to that. I think that this has been federal policy. I mean, we're trying to create mixed income communities. We're trying to encourage people to go to jobs. So I don't think anybody here is saying that we shouldn't have programs like that. I think the questions that we're raising is that while that is one policy, the history of our policies dealing with poverty haven't evolved to be one that is suburban focus, right? So when Head Start works off a model, I mean, every Head Start person knows it's 34 kids. It's 17 in the morning, 17 in the afternoon. It's five classrooms. It's all concentrated poverty. It all works when you're at a public housing project like Robert Taylor Homes. It's easy. When we move to the suburbs and we have poverty and we have kids who can benefit from Head Start, but we don't, we have more working poor, even though they may be in poverty, that this 17-17 five-classroom model all in one space doesn't work. Yeah. It needs to be melded with child care so that it can be full day, full year. It's less dispersed. And we may want to have a model where Head Start can work, not 100% poverty kids, all in one location. So, and then this plays out in housing, it plays out in health care, it plays out in human services. So it's not, I think that this is a great thing when we encourage diversity and mixed income communities, and so that the suburbs are not all rich and the city is all poor. I think nobody here would disagree with that. But what we need is a policy environment and a build up of infrastructure in the suburbs to support that overall policy.
Anybody else want to get in on that one?
Well, I think it really just goes back to what I was trying to express earlier, that the need for every neighborhood to be organized in a way that allows people to connect to opportunity, get an education for their children. And these are not, we're talking about either or. Either it's inner city, and either, if you're poor, really, you're looking for a set of things that are very similar. And people, you know, there's a tendency as we're talking to make it sound like we get to decide where people live, right? Oh, well, we think there are too many of them here and we'll put them here. Actually, people make very rational decisions about where can I afford some housing, where might it be the safest, where are the opportunities for my child to get an education. This is what they're thinking about. So it's a matter of, this is a human capital moment, too. Can I say that? Really, it's about investing in people. It's not about curing problems or fixing broken. It's about investing in people, wherever they may be, so that they can take advantage of these opportunities that are being created. And that is just a bridge we have yet to fully cross in the way we fund and the way we think. And then locking funding down further to geography, demographics, and even a specific kind of site or building doesn't allow us to use whatever hard capital has already been invested in the building. Let's repurpose it. Whatever resources, you know, in all of the neighborhoods we serve, 400,000 people a year, still 90% and above car dependent. So that has to be a factor. You have to figure that into any equation that says we're wanting to support folks. So it's just about taking the money and looking at the resources and the opportunities available and building the locally sensitive, taking advantage of what's already there response. And that's what we dream of again and again and again, and 10 different ways of saying it, but allow us to use what's available, repurpose it, shift it, combine it in new ways so that it works.
Yeah. I'm struck by the fact that you sort of have three things that you think matter, and you have three things that, I mean, it is really, you're just keeping your eye on a limited number of balls to try to deliver for the communities, whether they're suburban or urban, doesn't really matter. Now, let me take one more brief question so that we can move to our keynote speaker.
Okay.
sounds to me like the IFF is doing social entrepreneurship, but I'm not sure. And if not, is this being considered as a way of bringing in money on a continuous basis as opposed to depending on donations and government money?
Well, so the money that IFF brings in is for things. We would invest in Angela all day long and every day. But it's more on the tangible assets like childcare centers and health clinics and charter schools and human services facilities and equipment. So that's the capital that we are bringing in. But what we also try to do is organize foundation and government support of our nonprofit clients in ways that help them be more efficient in the suburbs or to do things smarter in the cities too.
Yeah, Angela, is that something you want to think about?
Just a quick thought on that. Mm-hmm. There are the different character of money. Government money is always going to be more restrictive, more prescriptive, more and slower to evolve and move to the local communities, and decisions are made about it from a distance. So some of the newer models that are emerging in the social entrepreneurship arena are so powerful because they are responsive. That is evolutionary money. That's the money that comes in. That's a dollar that doesn't already have a little tag on it that says you must spend it here this way for this particular service. So I think in addition to having public policy change to recognize the value of flexibility at the local level, having every nonprofit institution look at those sources of funding that are give you more breathing room. Yeah. It used to be that some foundations would play that role. Unfortunately, too many foundations have actually moved into sort of a bureaucratic model that resembles federal policy almost. And so I think nonprofits have to look for the entrepreneurial money so that you can be responsive
Outcome tag. You talked about tags. It's like if government, the programs I was talking about, government has an outcome tag.
Yeah.
It's here's what we want.
Right.
Here's some things that generally have to guide you getting there. Guide you, not prescribe you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the revolutionary money because we're okay with guides. But it's this outcome space. And I agree, foundations have got more into the wanting specific outputs. Let's talk about the outputs. Let's talk about the outputs. And we get away from the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And more of this government or foundations giving it an outcome tag is really what we're after.
Mm-hmm. Results. Just very quickly. Innovation. Mm-hmm. We keep hearing a lot about that. What we're doing is innovative. But you're talking about risk-averse systems that we're trying to do innovation in. Yeah. So if you want the innovation, you have to be willing to take that risk that whether it's in an organization like Angela's or Joe's or if it's in schools, let us do it. You have to, if we want to be STEM smart, you know, a lot of people who are dealing with sciences, failure is a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how you get creativity and innovation,
right.
And you can't have these conflicting things going on where you say you want this, but we're not going to provide an environment where you can.
Failing forward is the current term, and our boss Bruce likes to talk about this is the inevitable result of when you let your federal agencies be run by the inspector general's offices, because they don't have they're not the most risk tolerant of entities. So. We're going to move on to the keynote at this point. I'm so grateful to Joe and Mary and Angela for taking time out to be here today. Join me in thanking them. While I'm still here, I want to take the pleasure of introducing our keynote speaker today, Billy Shore. His bio, as everybody else's, is in your packet, and I bet for a lot of our members of the audience today here and Falk Auditorium, as well as around the country. He actually needs no introduction. He's one of the leading thinkers and doers in America on solving poverty, and particularly on the issue of hunger, as the founder and the president of Share Our Strength. It is a real honor to have Billy here today to speak on the subject from his really, really valuable vantage point. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Billy Shore.
Thank you. Thank you. thank you so much. I have absorbed so much fabulous information this morning. I just want to start by asking everybody to join me in congratulating Elizabeth and Al on this very important book. Fantastic. I'm going to be brief because the hour is late, and because I recently had a very sobering conversation with my 8-year-old son about my speaking style, and I'm going to just leave aside for a moment the improbability of my having an 8-year-old son, which didn't seem improbable to me. But I got my Facebook messages, my wife Rosemary and Nate and myself, and I got a Facebook message from a woman I went to high school with, and she said, I saw you on Facebook. Isn't it wonderful? I have a grandson, too. So, in any case, Nate he misbehaved recently with his babysitter for the first time, and he's such a good kid all the time. And my wife got very concerned about it. She called me at work. She said, you have to come home early. We have to talk to Nate about the choices he makes, his character, and his purpose on the planet. And Rosemary is an amazing mom, but a little bit intense. So we had this conversation, which was mostly a monologue, with Rode doing most of the monologuing. And afterwards, Nate was very polite. He just looked us dead in the eye. But afterwards, she had the very good sense, Rosemary, to say to Nate, is there anything in turn now that you would like to say to Dad and I? He just looked us dead in the eye, and he said, thank you for your little presentation. So I try to wrap up before I evoke that in audiences. And what I'd like to do is just make a couple comments that I think will pull together some of the themes that we heard here today. I was thinking of Luis's very compelling comments about this trajectory of the war on poverty and where we are today. And I actually, as you were talking, I thought of something else my son said, because I think it's an interesting blend of the idealism and the pragmatism that we have to bring to this fight. We get to spend a little bit of the summer at a little place called Goose Rocks Beach in Maine. And one morning, Nate was down by the water's edge, and there was another man with his 7 or 8-year-old down by the water's edge. And I saw him look around, and then he came up to me, and I saw he and Nate talking. And he came up to me, and he said, is that your boy? Is that other boy down there? And I said, yeah, why? And, of course, I had this, you know, constriction in my chest because I know the kind of things that Nate can say. And he said, well, I was building a sandcastle with my son, and your boy came up and he said something very interesting to me. He said, we're down there by the water's edge building the sandcastle, and your boy comes up and he puts his hands on his hips and he says, just so you know, I've seen a lot of these and they're never here in the morning. Now, that's one of the things that, one of the reasons I think that we have to make sure this time is different in terms of this, what I think of as this rededication that this morning is all about to this fight on poverty. What can we do to make this different? And the three things I'd like to talk about are, one is why this challenge is so difficult. Two is how we can do this work more powerfully. And three is what's at stake. In terms of why it's so difficult, to me at the heart of it is the issue of that some problems are so affect people who are so vulnerable and voiceless that there simply are no markets for solving them. There are no economic markets. There are no political markets, or at least those markets have failed in the way that we expect them to work. And so many of the organizations that are represented in this room, many nonprofit and many community organizations, bear this burden of having to fill in the gap, of having to solve this problem where the markets failed. That is the toughest possible thing to do. And it almost always has to do with people being voiceless. We've heard talk about poverty that is invisible. I'll give you one example of this from our work, which to me underscores what goes to the very heart of this. We're an anti-hunger organization that works primarily on childhood hunger in the United States at Share Our Strength. And one of the things that we know is that people in this country are not hungry because we lack food. We enjoy it in abundance. They're not hungry because we lack food and nutrition programs. We have those as well, and we've had them with bipartisan support for almost 50 years, whether it's school lunch program or the SNAP program, school breakfast or summer meals. Kids are hungry because they lack access to those programs. So the one example I'll tell you is that there's 21 million kids in the United States who get a free school lunch. They're all eligible for breakfast as well, for school breakfast, but only 11 million of the 21 million get it. And in the summertime when the schools are closed, only 3 million get it. Legislative programs that all of us and our predecessors fought for and won, and yet 84% of the kids who need meals in the summertime don't get it, and almost 50% of the kids who need breakfast don't get it. Why is that? perfect example. I go out to Colorado and have a conversation with Governor Ritter when he was governor just a few years ago before their current governor, Hickenlooper. Governor Bill Ritter, a terrific man, I think, former Peace Corps volunteer, worked on nutrition programs in, I think, Zambia for 3 years. So I knew that he was, you know, kind of sympathetically connected to what we were doing. And I went and talked to the governor. This was in the, you know, shortly after their economy had turned down like other state economies. He was in his office with, you know, literally legal pads full of budget figures and trying to figure out this state budget crisis. And we made some small talk, and he said, look, he said, just before you say anything, he says, I don't have any money for anything. Okay, and I said, well, I know that. I said, and I'm here for a reason maybe slightly different than you would expect. I'm here because Colorado ranks 47th lowest out of 50 states in the percentage of kids who are eligible for these programs, 47th lowest. Which means that you've left at least, by the most conservative estimates, $100 million in Washington that would be feeding these kids, would be buying milk from local dairy farmers, would be buying bread from local bakers, would be a win-win for everybody. And Governor Ritter turned to a staff person, as did Governor Perdue in North Carolina when I had this conversation, Governor McDonnell, Republican Governor of Virginia, Governor O'Malley in Maryland, Governor Snyder in Michigan, looked at his staff person and said, is that possibly true, right, at this time where we're as desperate as we are financially, that we've left $100 million in Washington, and they kind of do their calculation, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, that is true. And Governor Ritter said, well, why do we need this nice fellow from Washington to come tell us this? And to me, it was such a testament to just how voiceless and invisible these kids are, whether they're in urban areas, whether they're in suburban areas. A good governor who wants to solve problems, who is desperate to find money, doesn't even know that there's $100 million that can't be used for anything else but these kids. An entitlement program so small in the scheme of things that it's exempt from sequestration with Democratic and Republican support in an era where a lot of things are going away for kids, one of the few things that can be counted on. And this good governor doesn't know about it. It's an example of just how profound this voicelessness is and why these are such difficult problems to solve. But they are solvable. And in this second category of how do we do this work more powerfully, I want to just mention a couple of the strategies that at both Share Our Strength and our sister organization, Community Wealth Partners, we've brought to bear in this campaign to end childhood hunger around the country and to really think about its connection to the deeper issues of poverty. We know that poverty is complex, but we know that feeding a child is not. And so we've thought of five particular things that we had to bring to every aspect of what we were doing. One was just a very simple notion that we think of as go big or go home. This idea that you should set a bold but believable goal. I like to think of what the writer Jonathan Kozol talks about when he says pick battles that are big enough to matter but small enough to win. That seemed to be a construct that we wanted to really aim towards. And we said that we were going to, as we drilled down on all of the areas that we were working, because we were working on international hunger, we were working on hunger across all levels, we said childhood hunger in this country, really for the reasons that I was just describing, is a solvable problem. And we said, and we're going to actually make our goal to end it by a time certain. It had such a powerful impact on our organization to do that. Most of our colleagues who we work with in our anti-hunger community were actually against the idea. They had all kinds of concerns about what would it take and what if we failed and wouldn't that cost a lot of money and what about all of the other issues and so forth. Our corporate partners, our donors, our stakeholders, more broadly defined, all had the mirror image opposite reaction. You're telling me there's a goal line and you know how far you are from it and what it takes to get across, we want to be part of that. So this notion of go big or go home became central for us. The second thing we realized, and I think this is true for every organization represented in this room as you think about how to do this work more powerfully, is that we had to assert that capacity equals impact, that investing in our own capacity has a direct correlation between the impact that we want to have, and that we had to find ways to eradicate these false distinctions that are made about overhead and administrative expenses and so forth. Everybody who works in our organization is working towards the programmatic goal of ending childhood hunger, and we had to invest in our own capacity, sometimes even at the expense in the short term of funds that might have gone for more direct service or for more programmatic efforts. But we had to have this long-term vision in mind of how do we build our competitive strengths as an organization, and how do we make those investments that may not pay off until the long term, but will certainly be worth it. And that meant investing in talent in ways that we had never done before. That meant investing in branding in ways and in public relations and in communications in ways that we hadn't done before. I should tell you, and I use this only as a proxy because it's not an indicator of impact itself, but as we started to make some of these changes, we saw our revenues grow from in 2006, 7, and 8, like many organizations. We're 28 years old now. We had plateaued. We were stuck. We were raising and spending about $13 million a year. We started this organization 28 years ago, my sister and I, who's in the back of the room with a $2,000 cash advance on a Visa card. We've raised about $380 million so far today. But by 2006, 7, and 8, we had plateaued a little bit. We felt stuck. But the needs were increasing. And so we started to make these investments. We started to adopt these strategies. 2009, our revenues were $19 million. 2010, they were $26 million. 2011, $33 million. Last year, $44 million. This year, at about $50 million. Not a threat to the Ford Foundation yet, but for us, significant amount of growth. And it really, for us, changed the way we were able to do our work. So this notion that capacity equals impact. Third, accountability, such a powerful differentiator in a crowded marketplace, where regardless of how many people are committed to the work that each of us in our organizations are doing, they're being bombarded by other appeals, other solicitations, other opportunities to make change in the world as well. There's no apples-to-apples measurements. How do you judge whether it makes more sense to invest in Teach for America or a college summit or venture philanthropy partners or City Year or Share Our Strength? It's very hard to tell. So we decided that at least if we could give people the sense that we are holding ourselves accountable to a very specific outcome, and you can measure against how we are doing. And we can tell our stakeholders, we know, for example, that in 2010, 2012, we added 32,000 kids to the school breakfast program in the state of Maryland. 2011 and 2012, the single biggest increase ever. But we also know that we still have 54,000 left to go before we're done. And our stakeholders can, in any state and nationally, look and see how we're doing. It's a double-edged sword. When we're hitting our goals, investment increases in our work, as it should. When we're not hitting them, it decreases, probably as it should, as painful as that is to recognize. So this notion that accountability can be a powerful differentiator, I think also very important. Fourth, and this goes without saying to those who are both tuned into the webcast and those in this room, public policy, such a critical component to this work. I think the last question was about social entrepreneurship, and it was a good question, and many of us are considered to be part of the social entrepreneurial community. But I would argue that social entrepreneurship without being tied to public policy is kind of like a garage band without amps. It's something that everybody thinks is very cool and hip, but it doesn't really get heard very far beyond the neighborhood. When we started to understand as an organization that had been involved in the really almost completely in the private sector, funding food banks, funding emergency food assistance, funding advocacy efforts, but not looking directly like this strategy to increase participation in school breakfast, to increase participation in summer meals and other programs, not looking directly at the impact public policy could have, we realized that we were shortchanging our potential impact. And so what we've done on a state-by-state basis is to go in and try to understand what are the barriers to kids getting these meals. We found out that one of the most important things you could do is move breakfast, and this didn't require any money, but this was somebody after 50 years finally rethinking an important program. For 50 years, since generals and admirals came to Congress and said, we need to feed kids lunch and breakfast so we've got stronger troops, which is what they did after World War II. For 50 years, they've served breakfast, lunch in the cafeteria, and also breakfast in the cafeteria. Well, it's harder to get kids to go to breakfast in the cafeteria because they have to get to school early, and most of us can barely get our kids to school on time, wherever we live, whatever our means. There's also, for many kids, there was this stigma attached to being the kids who went to school early. Somebody came up with the idea of, why don't we move breakfast from the cafeteria to the first 10 minutes of the first period? Well, it turns out everybody objected to that idea. Teachers' unions said that our contracts say we don't have to clean up spilled milk. And the janitor said, our contract says we pick up the trash at 3:30. And the PTA said this might take away from instructional time. Los Angeles is a good example. We worked for a year in one school to launch breakfast in the classroom for the first 10 minutes over all of these objections. And 1 year later, Mayor Villagarosa and Superintendent of Schools John Daisy decided to roll it into 630 schools, which the school board voted on 7-0 last week, so that these kids get breakfast. Because what they've understood, what teachers will now tell you is it doesn't detract from education time. It actually increases it because every kid's in every seat on time. So we've been going and trying to rethink some of these, the way we've done things for a long time, in the interest of making public policy work. I think as Angela was saying, and Mary was saying, identifying programs that work and making sure that they get scaled. Finally, we've talked a lot about collaboration, and Collaborate was up on the screen in a big way. We do as much of that, I think, as anybody does at Share Our Strength, but we believe that we all also need to learn how to compete. Not to compete to put anybody else out of business, but to compete to be the very best, most powerful version of ourselves. I was on the board of the Timberland Boot and Clothing Company for about 11 years. Makes boots and apparel, and I'd never been on a corporate board. And one of the things I noticed, there were two things different from all the nonprofit boards I've been on, and I've been on many. One is at Timberland, when they made really important decisions, they made them on the basis of information. This was a huge shock to my system. I remember calling the office and saying, I think there's another way to do this, folks. But the other thing I noticed at Timberland was the board and the senior management of the organization was very focused on whether the company was organized to outperform its peers. And they were particularly focused on the belief that to compete at any level, you must compete at every level. So they understood that they weren't competing to sell us a pair of boots. They were competing to get the best people who work in fashion and footwear to come and work at Timberland and to make sure they're being paid competitively and that they're staying at Timberland longer than their peers stay at Cole Haan or Reebok or Echo or what have you. They weren't just competing to sell us t-shirts. They were competing to have a brand that stood for rugged environmentalism and outdoor use. And they were also competing and measuring how they were doing on that scale. So to compete at any level, you must compete at every level. In the nonprofit world, we tend to have the opposite instinct. How can we do it for the best of reasons? How can we do it cheap? How can we do it for free? How can we do it for pro bono? How can we do it with whatever resources are left over, as opposed to what are the best resources available? And so we've started to organize ourselves to compete in that way. Last thing I would say is, what is at stake as we start to think about how we redefine and re-understand poverty in America today? As we all know, the stakes are enormously high, and in a real-time way, the Congress, which is considering the Farm Bill, is under the best of circumstances going to cut the SNAP food stamp program. The Democratic-controlled Senate has proposed a $4 billion cut, the Republican-controlled House a $20 billion cut. We have 47 million Americans on food stamps for the first time in the history of the United States. Half of them are children. Secretary Vilsack told me recently that of all the kids in America today, one half of them will be on food assistance at some point in their lifetime. So this is uncharted territory. Just as poverty moving into the suburbs is uncharted territory, we are in uncharted territory. And probably the biggest cut of all will come to something called a SNAP Ed, which is a nutrition education program that does what you would think everybody would want it to do, which is to make sure that families know how to stretch their food dollars, know how to make choices that are healthy for their kids. But that's considered in this day and age a luxury. We know from a study we just did with Deloitte that showed in the schools where we're working, math scores are 17.5% higher, attendance rates are a day and a half longer. Attendance correlates to reading on grade level. Reading on grade level correlates to graduation rates. We know that investments that some think we may not be able to afford to make are investments that we can't afford not to make. Hopefully, this important book will help people understand that as well. We can't have a strong America with weak kids. We can't have a healthy economy with unhealthy kids. We can't have kids who are prepared to and an economy that's prepared to compete in the 21st century with children who are not prepared to learn. Something that James Baldwin, the author, once said, and I think Mary came very close to saying it, was that these are all our children, and we will profit by or pay for whatever they become. Let's hope we have the wisdom to make sure that what they become is smart and healthy and compassionate and wise and fully prepared to be part of America in the 21st century. Thank you for having me here today. Thanks for the work you've done.
Capacity and the organizations you heard from on the panel are doing just that, acting in an accountable and outcome-focused way and re-examining our old assumptions about where poverty is and how to fight it that are in many cases decades out of date. So I think that was just right in line with the challenges we're facing today and some of the solutions that are emerging out of metropolitan America. As Elizabeth and I write in the book, this is not an issue that we came to out of some lifelong obsession with the suburbs. We grew up there, and then we got out of there, and we moved to Washington, D.C. But our hope is that this book and the conversations that we're hoping to stage around the country to follow really spark a serious dialogue about how to meet the challenge of poverty in America today at its true scale. And we couldn't really have asked for a better start to that conversation than the effort we had here today. Thank you all so much for being a part of it.